roots music fans, going back decades, have a deep emotional attachment to Rounder and Sugar Hill. And part of the reason I wanted to meet you is to give them a sense of, you know, what kind of hands these precious labels are in today going forward. You've got a great catalog and you've got a future ahead of you. So what's your emotional attachment to these brands? What in your background makes you have the heart, not only beyond the skills?
Well, look, I'm a lifelong music fan, and you know, that's really been the center lane throughout my life is a passion for music, for song, for great songs, great singers. And Rounder's been in my life for my entire life. My father is an English professor, and his college roommate was Jim Rooney, if you know who that is.
Yeah, and producer, songwriter.
So they were good buddies at Amherst College, and Rooney, as he called him, used to come through. I grew up in Bloomington, Indiana, and he would come through for the Bean Blossom Bill Monroe Bluegrass Festival.
Right.
So I went to that as a kid, and my old man had a lot of great old folk and blues and jazz records and good number of Rounder titles. So I grew up with a very well-rounded musical education in that sense. Philo, that was another big one. And I moved to Boston in the 80s, and I tried to get a job at Rounder at one point. I wanted to work in the loading dock. I was a Berkeley student, and I had bands in Boston that were more in the rock, alternative, whatever you call it. We called it then college rock space. You know, that's really where my world was. But I was always a big fan of good country and roots music. So, you know, worked at Newbury Comics for a while, and I always owned a lot of Rounder records. So I Fort Apache was the studio I worked at. So Fort Apache was upstairs from Rounder, so I would spend a fair amount of time there. So not to belabor the point, but going way back, my tastes have been, you know, not specific to genre. My belief is that great artists transcend genre. And so, you know, I like some music of virtually every genre. I think most music that's out there is terrible, but I live for the cream of each genre. So, you know, do I have the proper respect for the history of these labels? I think absolutely I do. And you know, I have a great passion and knowledge for the history of these labels, and I did before it ever was in the realm of possibility that I would be doing the job I'm doing now. So
then you were a lawyer, entertainment lawyer, music lawyer for some years, right?
Yes, I was a lawyer. Well, I was a professional musician until I was 30.
Let's clarify that. Good.
I dropped out of Berkeley, and I, you know, had a band that was actually signed to Rounder at one point called Blake Babies. We were signed to Mammoth Records out of North Carolina and had some success. It was me and Juliana Hatfield. You remember her. And she went on to have a successful solo career, first at Atlantic, but then she was the first artist signed to Rounder's Zoe imprint. And then we got our old band back together in 2000 and made an album for Zoe. So I am a former Rounder recording artist. I guess I should mention that. That's relevant to the conversation. And the main band that I had success with was called the Lemonheads. And I spent a good number of years, you know, touring the world with that band. And when that band ended, I was ready to give up music, so I went to law school. I was frustrated with music. I found a lot of things about the music industry very frustrating and decided I should be done with it. But then as soon as I got done with law school and was working as a lawyer, I realized that I had to find a way back to music because that's really where my passion is. So I guess the next 10 years of my life were about figuring out how to use the toolbox I had as a lawyer for artist development. And I had pretty good success doing that. And a number of the artists that I worked with, starting basically from scratch, became, you know, household names artists. I worked with Bon Iver and Alabama Shakes and Civil Wars and Sturgill Simpson and Dawes. You know, these artists all went on to have real success. And I don't want to take too much credit for their success. They're obviously incredible musicians. But in each case, I was there for the, you know, the planning of how do you take this great artist and chart a course for them to, you know, to build a career and to protect their right to make music on their terms. And at some point a few years ago, I started to get a little frustrated with being a lawyer because I wanted to be more involved in the creative process. I didn't want to interfere with the creative process or insinuate myself, but I wanted to have a seat at the table. and to have more participation in, you know, making these records. And when Tom Wally, who's my boss, approached me about this job, I hadn't really thought about going to work for a label, but it made a lot of sense, because I think some people were nervous about the fact that there was a lawyer coming in to be the president around her, but I'd really sort of shoehorned this artist development infrastructure into the world of being a lawyer, you know, while protecting rights, while, you know, fulfilling the services of a lawyer. A lot of it was about artist development. So I think I brought a lot of perspective and skills to this from that background.
You mentioned several of the acts I was going to cite as evidence, maybe anecdotal evidence, but seems like strong evidence that this last decade has been a turning of the tide for the ability of indie and indie-oriented artists, artist-first artists, to blow up to very significant scale pretty quickly. Alabama Shakes being a quintessential example, St. Paul and the Broken Bones and some of the others you mentioned. There are real success stories now where I think if you look back 10 or 15 years, it felt like the niche will always be niche. What do you think you saw going on in the marketplace in these 10 years and going forward that makes that trend is here to stay?
Well, to me, a great voice connecting with a great song and you know, having a emotional resonance with a listener. I mean, that's what the music experience is about. And I think that when you're in business where you're in genres that are not, you know, mainstream pop genres, and you're trying to build something from the ground up, then at first you're relying heavily on music fans that have similar feelings about music. And the process of marketing, promotion, publicity is initially about connecting with real passionate music fans who are going to spread the word for you. It's a grassroots process, and you can feel when that grassroots process starts to take hold. You know, like, you remember when you first started hearing about Sergio, it was probably 2013, around his first record. It was, you know, probably from peers. You got to hear this guy. What a voice, right? And then the next thing you know, it's you know, knocking at the door of the mainstream, because that energy lifts it up. So one of the things that I want to accomplish professionally is to help to chart a course for those quality projects and genres that appeal to grown-ups to actually have a reasonably well-worn path to mainstream, to real mainstream success. And one of the reasons why I wanted to work at Rounder, which is Concord Music, by the way, is because one of my former clients is the Revivalists, if you've heard of them. And the promotion team at Concord Music was able to take that, you know, real grassroots, like, multi-genre band and, you know, take a song of theirs to top 40 radio. It's very, very rare to hear, you know, authentic or, you know, organic, real songs, you know, real instruments, real voices on top 40 radio these days. It shouldn't be. It should be more common. There should be a place for this kind of music in the mainstream. And I've seen it happen enough times in my law practice that I really believe it's possible. Mm-hmm. And I believe it's possible to have it become something that's much more consistent and much more reliable. When you're starting with great music, and, you know, I've assured everyone on our Rounder team that I'm not going to make them work on anything that isn't great. You know, if you start with great music and if you build it that way, you should be able to get there. You know, you should be able to build big careers.
What can you tell our folks about Concord? It's such an unusual company. It's the biggest, quote unquote, independent music company in the world now. And it is, but a lot of folks will have a suspicion that anything that big can't possibly be independent, or that it can't possibly maintain that indie ethos. And it's clearly not hit driven. You guys, from across this, the logos you see on the wall here, these are none of them labels that depend on hits. They right. depend on the organic artist development. But what is Concord in your mind?
Well, first of all, and I'll explain what it is in a moment, but what I'll say about, you know, why it's a good fit for me professionally is that it doesn't compromise any of my values when it comes to music, because I have certain values that are non-negotiable, and one of them is I don't interfere with an artist's creative process. And I don't, you know, I wouldn't ask an artist to sign a deal that I wouldn't feel comfortable signing myself if I were them, you know. So it has to be objectively artist-friendly. That doesn't mean the company can't make money. You know, it has to be a value for value, and it has to be, you know, tailored to the circumstances. It's going to be a different deal if it's a superstar artist versus a brand new one where you have a big mountain to climb. But nothing about what I'm doing at Rounder and Concord is compromising my own values as a musician, as an artist advocate, as a, you know, a lover of music. And, you know, I believe in developing artists to, you know, to fulfill their goals and their potential, you know, without interference. So, and that's, I'm not saying that major labels necessarily interfere with artists, but it is more of a process of taking talent and turning it into commercial product. I think there's an assumption in commercial genres and major labels that, you know, that they, you have to put music through that process to make it commercial.
But also the expectations for sales revenue are higher than you all would start as a baseline threshold.
That's right. That's right. I mean, we're thrilled if it if it's, you know, something that's, you know, getting in the top 100, whereas, you know, majors would be much more inclined to be focused on streaming numbers before they're going to spend any money at radio or something like that.
Okay.
But what Concord is it's really an interesting model, actually. It was originally Concord Records was a jazz label, and it was still a pretty modest jazz label through the 90s. And the company got ambitious, and they raised some money, and they started acquiring these iconic label brands and their catalogs, including Vanguard and Sugar Hill you know, of course, Rounder and you know, other genres like Razor and Tie is you know, Heads Kids Bop, that's an asset. Wind Up was, you know, the label that Creed had success on, and Fearless Records is a Southern California basically punk label. You know, so it's a pretty broad range of assets, but they have these iconic music, you know, for lack of a better word, brands like Stax, like Fantasy Records. And recently they've been acquiring publishing assets as well. So they're consolidating their publishing assets, and they'll emerge this year as, I think, the third biggest independent publisher, with Imachim is a European company, and Razor and Tie Publishing and Bicycle. So it's not quite the size of a major label, but it's bigger than any other independent. And my boss, well, I should talk a little bit about my boss, Tom Wally. He's a real icon in the industry, and he's a guy who's really built an amazing career on artist development. He was a guy that started in the mailroom at Warner Brothers and worked his way up to, you know, a lofty role there. And then he was one of the founders of Interscope Records, and went on later to be the president of Warner Brothers for quite a long stretch through the 2000s. And now he's founded a label within Concord called Loma Vista, which... One of the things you see as an artist lawyer that most people don't see is musicians' perceptions of labels and, you know, which labels they want to be on. It's usually not a really articulate, you know, thoughtful, like, I've, you know, I'm aware exactly of what this is. They just know which labels are cool. And they know which labels are cool because of which other bands are on those labels. So every indie rock band wants to be on, you know, Merge Records, because that's Arcade Fire, you know, that's Superchunk, whatever, you know. So that's one of the challenges that we have with Rounder, is how do we preserve the integrity of the label with the people that actually have a relationship with the label, while rehabbing it within that community of musicians so that they'll think of it as a cool label, you know, Rounder's cool. Some people think of it as cool. Certainly bluegrass people think of it as cool. But if we're trying to sign the acts that would, you know, typically go to ATO or New West or Secretly Canadian, we have to get on that list of currently relevant, cool labels that they want to be on. Right. And that's all about, you know, what we're signing and what we're putting out. So obviously we stay in the bluegrass space, and we have to be preeminent there, because that's what Rounder and Sugar Hill have been incredible at for decades. You know, great acoustic music, great traditional folk bluegrass. But then, you know, to develop projects that are going to actually connect, you know, in the sort of rising tide of Roots Americana projects that are actually connecting commercially. So
right.
That's the challenge, is how to preserve it and how to build it there. So, you know.
How will Rounder and Sugar Hill relate in terms of identity? What are your plans for having them have their own personality?
Well, that's a difficult one. That's a challenge that I'm, you know, sort of it's a learning process for me. Not that I don't understand what those brands have meant historically, because I do. But one of the it's not exactly a challenge. It's actually an incredible gift. Is that the founders of Rounder Records, the three individuals who started the label back in 1970, selling records out of the trunk of their car at fiddle conventions, they're all still involved. They don't own the label anymore, but they definitely have a seat at the table, and they bring projects to us. And so a lot of the traditional folk projects and bluegrass projects that you see coming out on Rounder are actually A&R'd by the founders of the label, which is a great connection to the past. I love bluegrass music, but I don't want to reinvent myself as a bluegrass expert, because I have to have a broader vision. And the A&R side, you know, I'm thinking way more about, you know, what's the act that's going to be a great look for Rounder that's going to break, you know. So I have, you know, literally the founder of the label, who's been doing it for the last almost 50 years, out there scouting bluegrass projects for me. That's amazing. When I didn't understand all of that, I was thinking that Sugar Hill would be, you know, something that we would build as you know, a place for traditional, you know, roots acoustic projects. But you know, since the scout that's actually bringing in those projects is, you know, so closely identified and so emotionally connected to Rounder, it would be very disrespectful to him to start putting him on Sugar Hill. So I think what I'm going to do is to you know, as I get more in touch with the historic identity of Sugar Hill, some of the new acts that we sign, you know, we'll decide for aesthetic reasons should be on Sugar Hill. Then we have artists who are on the label still who you know, like Sam Bush and Sarah Jarosz, who are already on Sugar Hill. You know, obviously if we're blessed to have them continue working with the label, then you know, they should continue to be associated with Sugar Hill. And you know, Liz Longley is Sugar Hill. You know, obviously I'm not going to force her to go back to Rounder. I have great respect for what these companies are and their catalogs. And, you know, obviously it's incredible to have those catalogs be part of this company. But going forward, you know, I just want it to be thoughtful, and I want it to be respectful, and I want it to be something that's going to create the kind of, you know, distinction in the marketplace where people are going to say, oh, it's a Sugar Hill release. I know what that's going to be about. You know, I know that's going to be great. And, you know, it's definitely going to be my taste because of the other artists that are on Sugar Hill. That's always the way it's worked, right?
That's right.
So we just have to be, we have to be thoughtful about it.
Yeah.
It's an incredible, very humbling opportunity to be able to make these decisions, you know. And it's something I do very much in conversation and collaboration with people with some depth at these labels.
On a bigger picture about the music business and about the commercial potential for the artists that we at our radio station and in the community love and want to see thrive. I feel like generally we're getting past the gloom and doom stage. The news tells us that streaming revenue is moving upward at a measurable rate. That's very important to labels like Rounder and Sugar Hill. And what do you see? What's the possibility? Because we do know that the selling the record is the thing that has fallen off the cliff and is never going to come back exactly. But how do you figure that?
Well, first and foremost, I'm very excited and grateful that there's a way to make money from recordings, and that's, you know, in the subscription streaming space. And I'm on record going back, you know, 10 or more years saying that I thought that was probably the way forward. You know, way before there was a launch of a subscription streaming service in the U.S. And I took a lot of flack for that because, you know, people are understandably very protective of a lucrative model, like selling physical product. But you know that as technology speeds up and as ease of distribution increases by the, you know, by the week, that's going to be endangered. And, I mean, you could see it with the rise of file sharing. You know, why would you go buy a CD? Would you get it for free? So I know that this is a really sensitive subject because this has hit some true independent artists really hard, like artists who are making their living from playing small rooms and traveling and selling CDs and vinyl directly to their fans. You know, it's been hard because they know that they can walk out of that venue and listen to it on Spotify. And I think artists are starting to understand that keeping their music off those services is is not a good career move. You know, you need to have your music accessible if you want people to hear it. And so it's a tough one, and I'm not sure how to advise people like that. You know, for us, I'm grateful because this is, you know, as sales decline inevitably, as you know, download sales decline inevitably, we're going to see this rise in streaming revenue, and that's, you know, it's appearing that it's going to be enough to support a business like ours and a company like Concord. Now, there are a few big challenges in there, which I'm very aware of, and I think the biggest challenge is the way that music for grownups is marginalized in streaming. I have three kids at home, and they love pop and hip hop, and I see how they listen to music, and they take access to premium Spotify for granted. You know, they it's like water from the shower when they get up in the morning. It's like they each have their own Sonos speaker. They each can access it, and they listen to music, and they use the discovery tools, and they use them really effectively, and they share music, and it's, you know, a very interactive social experience for them. But they're very engaged with mainstream music. They're not taking a deep dive into other genres. And I've noticed that, like, I taught both of my parents, long divorced, but both pushing 80, I taught them how to use Spotify and taught them how to, you know, set up a Sonos speaker and listen to music. They were thrilled. But what do you think they did? They went and recreated their album collections. You know, you go and you search for all the music you want to hear, you save it so you can access it, you know. There's a huge difference between how old people listen to music and how young people listen to music. And I think the challenge is when you're building a company on genres that are in danger of being marginalized, to make sure that the streaming services are serving those genres as well. We'll never have the same kind of numbers. Like if you look at Jason Isbell's numbers on Spotify compared to his physical sales, you know, they're not in line. It's like his Spotify numbers are nowhere near, you know, like a Lil Yachty or something like that, but he can sell more tickets, you know, and sell more albums. So, you know, I think the majors are getting really seduced by the quick money of getting traction on Spotify, which is probably going to result in them more and more getting out of these prestige genres. That's good for us because that opens up a lane for mm-hmm. companies like Concord. But we have to make sure that, you know, there's enough going on there and enough traction so that the genres aren't marginalized.
To wrap up, 2 minutes of hype. What do you got right now that you're excited about? What's coming? What would you tell the world about?
I'm so frustrated because there's you know, a couple projects that we're so close to having, you know, announcing and having it long form. We're going to have an incredible year. I was just, you know, sitting in a room with some of my Concord Music colleagues, you know, the high-up people, sort of giving them a look at what's coming up this year. But I couldn't be more excited about I'm With Her. That's out now. That's on Rounder. It's being incredibly well received. Aoife O'Donovan and Sarah Watkins and Sarah Jarosz mm-hmm. is a trio. Incredible music. That's one that was already signed when I got here, just lucky for me. There's an artist named Michaela Davis, who's a harpist from Rochester, New York, who's incredible. That's coming out this year. There's a couple tracks up already, or I think one track and another coming soon. Rustin Kelly is a local singer-songwriter, former client of mine, who we've signed around her, who's made an amazing album. And he, I think, played a session for your station recently.
He did.
Here in our office. I could not be more thrilled to have Rustin on the label. We signed a band from South Carolina called Susto, which is not coming out till 2019, but it's an amazing band that I couldn't be more excited about. They're sort of like Wilco for the kids. Great songwriting, just a rock band. And we've got a few other amazing things coming up. So on the A&R side, in terms of what we've been able to bring in the door, I could not be more thrilled.
John, thanks for the time. It's fascinating.
Thank you so much.